You will hear a number of different recordings, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in four sections. Write all your answers in the listening question booklet. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to an answer sheet. Now turn to section 1. Section 1.
In today's lecture, I want to look at one of Australia's least loved animals, but one that has an interesting history from which I think we can learn a fundamental lesson about problem solving. While Australia is famous for its many wonderful native animals, in particular the kangaroo and the koala, it also has some less attractive animals, many of which were actually brought to Australia in the 19th and 20th centuries. First, perhaps the most well-known introduced animal is the rabbit, brought originally by the early settlers as a source of food. Another animal to be introduced by the settlers was the fox, and this was for the purpose of sport in the form of fox hunting. But perhaps the most unusual animal ever brought here was the cane toad. Here is a picture of one. It's a large, and some people would say very ugly, species of toad, and was deliberately imported to this country by the sugarcane farmers in 1935 in an attempt to eradicate the beetle which destroys the sugarcane plant. So, how does the beetle do this? Well, it lives in the cane and drops its eggs onto the ground around the base of the plant. The eggs develop into grubs and then they eat the cane roots. This, as you would expect, is far from good for the plant, and the result is, of course, that within a short period of time, the plant dies. The problems all happened because in the mid-30s there was a serious outbreak of cane beetle, and the farmers became desperate to get rid of the pest which was ruining their livelihood. About this time, news was trickling in from overseas about a toad, which supposedly ate the beetles which killed the cane. It was reported that this cane toad, which was native to Central America, had been taken to Hawaii, where cane is also grown, and introduced with apparent success. So, with the backing of the Queensland authorities, the farmers arranged to import 100 toads from Hawaii. The toads were then released into the cane fields to undertake the eradication of the cane beetle. As predicted, the toads started to breed successfully, and within a very short time their numbers had swollen. But there was one serious problem. It turned out that cane toads do not eat cane beetles. And the reason for this is that toads live on insects that are found on the ground, and the cane beetles live at the top of the cane plant, well out of reach of the toads. In fact, they never come into contact with each other. Now, you may well ask, how did this terrible mistake ever happen? And the reason is quite simply that the farmers were desperate to find a way of ridding their fields of the cane beetle, and so they accepted the reports that had been written, without ever doing their own research. Meanwhile, much of tropical northeast Australia is infested with the cane toad, which serves no purpose whatsoever, and experts claim that the toad is spreading south in plague proportions. The added irony is that in 1947, just 12 years later, an effective pesticide was developed which actually kills the beetle, thereby ensuring the survival of the sugarcane industry to this day. Now, as agricultural scientists, we have to ask ourselves, what lessons are to be learned from this tale? And I can think of three main points. Firstly, one should never rely on claims which are not backed up by evidence, i.e., in this case, evidence that the cane toad actually eats the grub of the cane beetle and thereby kills the pest. Secondly, we should look very carefully at possible effects of introducing any living species into a new environment. And lastly, one should not allow one's decision-making to be influenced by a sense of desperation, which may cloud the issue. In other words, One should always seek objective advice.
Section 2. You will hear part of a local radio program in which the head of the Park Art Center is interviewed about events that are going to be held at the center. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 20. Now listen to the conversation and answer questions 11 to 20.
And next on City Life this week, we have with us in the studio Harvey Bowles, head of the Park Arts Centre. He's here to tell us about forthcoming events at the centre. Harvey, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
So, what can we look forward to first at the Park Centre?
We've got a very exciting programme lined up for you. The next event will start on the 18th of February and run till the 24th. Times for the event? Twice each day at 2:30 and 7:30 p.m. There'll be a folk music concert and we're sure this is going to be very popular. A range of excellent musicians are coming, some playing for their first time in this country. And for those who want a souvenir, or for people who don't manage to get to the performances, the foyer shop will be selling a CD showcasing the great talents of the performers.
Sounds good.
Yes. And then after that, our next event is starting on the 1st of March and runs for 8 days. There's a lot going on, so you'll need to look in the separate programme, which shows all the various times and so on. It also includes details of performers and ticket prices. You can pick one up from the foyer at the centre. Yes, this year we're hosting the dance festival again, and it's going to be even bigger than last year. It's become a major feature of the arts year, and many of the performances will be recorded on video and DVD. But nothing can beat the thrill of attending the events live. We have a great range of styles, performed by over 100 groups, representing as many as 4 continents. All I can say is book early, because many of the shows are going to sell out quickly.
I'm sure they will. And what do you have for us after that?
Well, then things get a little quieter, but no less interesting. From the 14th to the 20th of March, every evening at 8, we go into cinema mode and we're showing a fine new film. I expect you've seen reviews of it. Love and Hope.
Oh, yes, wonderful.
Yes, and it's not just an ordinary screening. We're delighted that each screening will be introduced by a short lecture by the producer, who will also leave a little time for questions from the audience. Again, I recommend early booking for this. It's bound to be popular.
I'll be there. Anything else lined up at this point?
Yes, we've got a special one-day event on April the 2nd. The times aren't fixed yet, but I can tell you that we're having a singing competition.
Oh, yes?
There'll be a large number of entrants, and the talent should be impressive. And Channel 6 are coming, so the event is going to be shown on TV. So, come and be part of the audience.
I'm sure people will want to. Well, Harvey, thank you very much for coming in and telling us all this. Details of all the events are on your website, aren't they?
Yes, yes, the address is www.
That is the end of Section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 3. Section 3. you will hear three students, Ben, Jane, and Tom, having a discussion about their architecture and design studies course. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 21 to 25.
So, Tom, did you manage to get all your reading done?
Yes, Ben, I did. What about you, Jane?
Me too, though it took much longer than I thought it would.
Yeah, some of those dissertations are really long, aren't they?
I'm not looking forward to having to write mine.
Well, that's not till next year.
So, shall we compare thoughts about our reading? Let's start with 20th century architecture. I thought it was pretty impressive.
There was quite a bit of detail.
Yeah, all very relevant. I enjoyed the pictures, the diagrams and photos.
They were quite strange. Not what you'd expect to find in a dissertation, but very helpful.
Whereas sometimes I couldn't really follow the arguments.
Yes, a bit of a mixed bag, really. While modern construction was very serious and thorough, wasn't it?
Indeed. Actually, it was rather dense. I didn't find it particularly easy to read either.
The index was excellent, though, so I used that to guide me around.
I still think it was a bit high level. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to try and cope with it in the first year.
No. That's not who it's aimed at, of course. What about steel, glass and concrete? Not the world's most interesting title, of course.
Again, the index was helpful. Though I think we could have done with more photos. There weren't really enough to support what he was saying in places.
Yeah. But what he was saying was easy to follow, wasn't it? He takes you through step by step.
It was hard to believe it had been translated. Seemed very natural.
Actually, it was better written than the next one. The space we make.
But we're supposed to be thinking about architectural ideas, not being literary critics. I like that one.
Really? I just didn't think it covered the whole situation.
It didn't put the question of housing into the context of the time.
You mean how in the 50s, economic austerity limited the finances available while a growing population needed housing quickly?
Exactly.
Again, I think you're asking too much of these dissertations.
Perhaps you're right. Well, I did like change and tradition, anyway. Very focused.
Yes, although I did think it was oddly arranged in some ways. When you went to the index to track something down, you couldn't necessarily find what you wanted.
I know what you mean. But I have to say, I'd be very proud if I'd written any of these.
True.
And you will next year.
Now you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the conversation and answer questions 26 to 30.
Never mind next year. It's this year that's the problem. I'm never going to get this assignment done.
Yes, you are.
Come on, let's make a plan for you.
Oh, please. I'm just not sure where to go from here. I could look at city plans, study the layout of housing developments.
I think you need a closer focus. The approach to small houses won't necessarily tell you what you want to know. You'd be better to concentrate on large private houses. Study the drawings of those.
Okay. Though I don't know how much useful detail I'll be able to get from the kinds of plans that are easily available from that period.
It's true. They can be limited. But what you could do as a next stage is go onto the web. There's loads of useful stuff there.
More detailed plans, you mean?
Well, I was thinking more of illustrations, that kind of thing. Do a search for window designs. I'm sure you'll find some good ones.
I agree. And not just online. See what you do find there, and then, for your next step, check both campus libraries. I think you'll be able to get hold of books which will give you further information. And you need to know more about typical furniture of the time.
This is all very helpful. Thanks, guys. I'm beginning to think I should be able to get something done for Dr. Forbes after all. At least I can see I'll be in a position to tell him the section headings.
Well, a bit more than that would be better. Put your outline plan together and give him that to look at.
Hmm, yes. But I'll still need to keep reading, won't I?
Yeah. Once Dr. Forbes has okayed what you've done at that point, you could then go and see Dr. Gray. He's very approachable, and I'm sure he'd be happy to provide you with further references, and then you could take it from there.
That'd be really useful. Well, thanks again. Let me get you both another coffee.
That is the end of Section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4. Section 4. You will hear part of a lecture about the early history of cinema. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen to the lecture and answer questions 31 to 40.
Now, we all take the wonders of the cinema very much for granted these days, but cinema really is a very recent phenomenon. It has moved from its origins in the simple still camera to the dazzling computer-generated graphics of today in little over 100 years. Perhaps the real beginning of cinema was the cinematograph, a moving camera invented by the Lumiere brothers. As the excitement at the early screenings of short, simple moving pictures spread, competition developed rapidly, and soon cameras such as the American Biograph were on the market. Advertisements asserted that the Biograph did not shake as much as the cinematograph. Meanwhile, permits were acquired for outside filming, and import licenses were difficult to obtain for equipment, and there were other difficulties for cameramen. When the Lumiere brothers went to film the crowning of Tsar Nicholas II in Russia in 1896, the camera's ticking noise led people to believe it was a bomb. Although this confusion was resolved, disaster struck at the ceremony when a stand of spectators collapsed and the huge crowd panicked. The cameramen kept filming. It was the first time such events had been filmed, and this marked the beginning of a new concept of journalism. Well, the technology continued to develop rapidly, and often secretly. The thrill of invention and the prospect of riches to be made drove experimenters along. But historians of cinema face difficulties in establishing if an apparatus functioned in the way that its makers asserted. Everyone was keen to say that their machine was the best, of course. In some cases, however, we do have reliable records or evidence in the equipment itself, and then we can see the details of the evolution of the technology. By about 1890, for example, the Frenchman Marais had arrived at results of startling clarity in sequential images. He also had the idea of recording images on a long strip of paper that unrolled in front of the lens instead of on separate plates. But he found it impossible initially to ensure that this strip would have regular movement. As we step into the 20th century, however, we see much progress has been made, and there are many examples of what we would today recognize as films.
Questions of the art form were now as important as questions of what was technologically possible, and filmmakers searched around for ideas to draw on. Comic strips were very popular at the time in newspapers, and their structure was applied to the planning of films, which were now being mapped in a series of picture panels. Different innovations were achieved by different types of filmmaker, with a certain amount of rivalry between makers of documentaries and makers of fiction films. One area where documentaries led the way was in the use of travelling shots, although, of course, fiction films adopted this technique in due course. Various sources for stories were developing, and each would have an impact on the way the story was filmed. For example, filmmakers started to use greater numbers of shots when chase films became popular, because they wanted to show the various stages of the policeman running after the bandit and so on. And it wasn't just different kinds of story that were driving filmmakers to think up new techniques. Other technology also played its part. The telephone was growing in use, and filmmakers came up with the idea of splitting the screen image into two parts to show telephone conversations. All this growing sophistication in the shooting of films began to make the whole process of creating them more challenging. The very first films consisted of single shots and were straightforward to take from shooting to showing them to audiences. However, as the filming developed into multiple shots, then editing emerged as an essential ingredient of the process. Cinema was growing up. Well, next, I'd like to turn your attention to some of the issues that I believe were...
That is the end of Section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers.